Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Wild Bunch.
With your hosts,
Gregory Valdez
and Joe Hernandez.
Hello, Joe.
Hello, Greg. How are you today?
I'm doing fucking fantastic.
That's good to hear, man. I'm doing well as well. I'm very excited. We promised you last week, audience members, that we are going to be talking about comedy.
And comedy is something very dear to our hearts because we're soulless motherfuckers.
You know, the thing I like about comedy is that it is so multifaceted in this world. I mean, you could have comedy in a movie, a television show, a stand-up show. You have comedy going to a grocery store and talking to a random stranger.
I feel like there's a lot of comedy in funerals.
There can be. There can be. I've heard many eulogies that have made me laugh quite frequently.
I was just speaking specifically about the fucked up family members who show up and want to cause fights.
Oh, don't get me started on that.
There's nothing like an El Paso funeral.
So anyways, today we have a very, very special guest, one who holds comedy dear to his heart. Greg, would you like to introduce him?
We are here with San Antonio's up-and-coming comic, or whatever he wants to call himself. Look, I call him the fucked-up Gen Z Seinfeld. He doesn't like Seinfeld that much, but that's okay. This is Angel Baeza.
Hey, hello world. Glad to be here. Glad to be with this soulless motherfucker. That's what he calls himself. I don't know if he likes that, but I'm calling it because he does it to me.
If he can say you're like Seinfeld and you're not liking Seinfeld, I think it'd be okay that you call him that. Yeah, there's some truth to it.
Right.
There's some truth
to it. It is, in a way. And I've met Angel through doing some open mics in town, just going out to the comedy scene, and not to be creepy about it, but I've noticed him as a very, very funny fucking comedian and really enjoy his stand-up, I've never watched him write, but from what I can tell, his writing is really put together in a way that it's more to it than just getting up and saying something funny. It's cerebral, it's contemplative, and says something about himself and where this generation is.
Yeah, meeting Angel, I barely met him about an hour ago, and gotta say, one thing I noticed about you, Angel, is you're a very smart guy. Very well-spoken, very intelligent, very knowledgeable about things. So that being said, go ahead and tell us and tell the listeners a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I would probably wouldn't use any of those words.
That's why we did.
Yeah, that's okay. Setting very high expectations for some pretty dumb dick jokes. I'm a local student at Trinity. I've been doing comedy for about 2 years. Most often perform at the Blind Tire Comedy Club. You guys should go there every Friday. Plug. Sorry, guys.
No,
that's a real advertisement.
That's okay.
It's better now than later.
That's actually the first venue that I went to see stand-up comedy. So
ever in your life?
Yes, ever. Never seen a show until Blind Tiger. Me and Greg went. Oh, it was years ago, actually, that we went.
It was almost 3 years ago, actually.
Yeah.
I wasn't even allowed there until recently, so.
That's true, I didn't think of it that way.
So you've come a long way since then.
Yeah, exactly.
Tell us about your first gig, Angel.
When I started, I'm kind of over it now, but when I started, I used to have a big speech impediment.
Okay.
Caused from anxiety, and slowly I've gotten over it, but basically, only the front row could hear me.
Okay.
And everyone else is saying, speak louder,
uh-huh.
And then they laughed. Hopefully.
Were you nervous at all? I know that's such a generic question, but
I'm nervous right now.
Really? Wow. Okay. Yeah, it's good. It's good to be nervous. It makes things flow a little bit better, especially with comedy. Yeah. Honestly, man, I gotta say mad respect to you because it seems terrifying to go up on stage and tell jokes because there's always that fear of no one's gonna laugh, which sucks. So have you ever had a set that just tanked completely?
Yes. Occasionally they'll have mics, and they'll advertise them on the show on their website.
Okay.
But no other people will show up.
Oh, okay.
So you're just the only guy, and then people are playing pool, and they turn off the radio because they're playing the radio.
Yeah.
And they turn off just for comedy.
Uh huh.
And then people just yell out, "Turn the radio back on."
Oh man, that's messed up.
Music.
So what's worse, a bad small crowd that's not paying attention like that, or a very large crowd that's not responding to your jokes?
I've never had a large crowd. No, I've never had large crowds. Are usually pretty easy. They laugh at anything. At least they're friendly.
Okay.
Because it's kind of hard to be vitriolic in a big group.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Cool.
Or at least the type of people who go to big crowds.
And on that note, there's this mob mentality where it only takes about one person to laugh.
Yeah.
For it to kind of spread throughout a crowd and ease them into possibly laughing at you with you.
Mics are way harder than shows. You don't even compare the two, honestly.
One of the things I notice about mics is that it's almost like you're performing for other comedians specifically, depending on how many people are on the list.
Yeah, a little bit. That's basically how you do it. You have to learn how to judge your material based on their faces eventually. Like, oh, this person paying attention. Oh, they're smiling. Because they're not going to be able to laugh because the person before you just talked about how their mom died or whatever. So they're not able to get past the context, but their expressions can usually tell you how the joke's doing.
I like that a lot. It doesn't have to be vocal, per se.
Yeah. You want it to be. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. You want it to be.
I was going to return quickly to the question about being nervous because I wanted to frame it in a different way. Is it the fact that you could not be laughed at what makes you nervous, or something else?
I'm confused by the question. What do you,
is it really
in one context? Am I nervousness?
If you're gonna get up to do stand up anywhere, is it that you aren't going to be funny that makes you nervous, or something else?
I'm not as nervous now, but when I first started, it was just, I literally had a speech impediment where I went to a speech therapist, and what made me nervous most was not being understood vocally. It's not some big philosophical thing that's going to apply to everyone.
Yeah.
But for me, it's always trying to get my voice heard and be well-spoken, which I've only been able to do like the past year and a half. Honestly.
Was having that speech impediment part of that inspiration for you to do stand-up comedy?
Sure. Like, I love Woody Allen. I love very nervous comedians, which is kind of who I copy myself after.
Okay.
Norm Macdonald has this great quality where he's able to mumble through the setup but then say the punchline clearly.
Uh-huh.
Which I always really like.
Cool. I like that. I like and respect that. A lot of things that we talk about here on the podcast, you know, fear being something we talked about heavily last week. But it seems like you took this, you know, even the word impediment, this thing that holds you back, and you're like, well, I'm going to do the exact opposite of what this impediment states and go up there and speak freely and openly. I think that's very cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fun. Also, that's what you're supposed to do as far as trying to get over social anxiety or any phobia. You should probably try to just approach it head on.
Do the opposite of what the phobia dictates.
Yeah.
An exposure in that way.
Cool.
That's really the perfect setup. In fact, I didn't even realize that we would touch on anything like that, but that's what we'd like to talk about a lot specifically we're here to talk about comedy. If that's today's topic, and there are other ways to look at comedy, but we've always talked about self-identity, complacency, and other realms of everyday living that you don't think about behind the scenes. And for you, behind the scenes, it's not just about making people laugh, but also about being understood, whether it's literally when you speak or through a joke.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. The audience doesn't realize it, but comedy has a lot of layers. There's the line has to be funny. The voice has to be a little funny, just audibly. You have to, like, oh, I know who that is.
I do like your inflection on stage, by the way.
Thank
you. It's a character.
It's a character. I'm not... people say I speak differently on stage, off stage. I also speak differently in interviews. Every context is different. You have to speak differently. And then on top of that, you have to have a narrative and a sort of like a personality. It's very... There's layers to it. And they all add up and multiply and make it funnier.
And it is. It's really funny. Yeah. I've told Joe about this bit, and I'm not gonna like go into it. It's your bit and everything, but it's specifically the one about, at least from the sets I've seen where you get into it, you ask the crowd if they want to hear some dark humor. and then you roll into this joke about being with your friend, and he's Indian and telling him he has a red dot on his forehead.
Oh yeah, that's not as complicated. That's just a Anthony Jeselnik type of joke.
Okay.
Where it's like, oh, I'll just do this thing where they don't know where it's going, but it's not as horrible at the end. Yeah.
It's like that huge shock value where you just gasp, and because of that gasp and you can't believe what you just heard, you're forced to laugh. I love jokes like that. I love comedians that are able to cross those lines and kind of exploit that kind of thing to get a crowd to laugh.
Yeah, I don't like to cross the line exactly, but I like to approach it a little bit.
It was, in hearing and watching you perform it, it's subtle. So for our listeners, I don't know if you'd want to like just say the punchline.
I hate doing jokes in conversation. Basically, the joke is what makes a one-liner work, at least as far as misdirection, is you try to hide two narratives and then you have one thing you hide behind. So the thing that's connecting the Indian dot, what makes it seem edgy is that I'm criticizing him for having a red dot on his forehead. He says that's racist, but then he gets shot by a sniper.
So it not being racist at all.
I'm not being racist at all.
Yeah, it's not even
like people think I'm racist.
Yes,
it's just very violent.
Something I talk about a lot in comedy or outside comedy is subversion. Mm-hmm. There's that expectation you have going into a situation, and when you can turn the tables to deny that expectation and deliver something else, whether it's narrative within a story, within writing, within fiction, even memoirs and nonfiction, there's still this air of, I expect something, this is how it could end, this is how it's not gonna end, and then it becomes even funnier in that.
I think it's cool because even if someone is hearing this and they don't find it funny or they don't laugh, they're still gonna remember it just because of that switch flip that it does to their mind. It kind of hits the mind in a way where it stands out to them, as opposed to a run-of-the-mill joke where you can see it coming as they start telling the joke.
Mm-hmm, that's exactly how I see it. It's funny how memory works, because people never remember the actual punchline. They always remember the moment.
Uh-huh.
They always remember, oh, he was talking about this thing, and then it was funny, but I have no idea what the joke was.
That is a beautiful segue, because that moment is also what we want to talk about today. That the moment is the engrainment of the situation, the joke, it becomes a memory. Mm-hmm. It makes people laugh. It makes people walk away from that and feel a certain way and smile. Why is that important? Comedy does that. We know that it does that, or it can do that, has that capability. But why is that important? I mean, you can answer that as in why is it important to you, or go beyond that, or both, preferably. And why is it important for everyone?
Sure. The nice thing about laughter is that it's a sign of, okay, we're fine. No one can laugh and be, you know, scared at the same time. You just can't do that. You can't inhale from a gasp and laugh at the same time. You can't biologically do that. So it's nice when you want to talk about a little darker stuff, to have that laughter as a reinsurance as an audience, so we can go through it. With poetry, it's sort of different because you're by yourself, so it's not really a social function, so you don't need that sign of we're all good here. But when you try to do that in public, it's a little harder to do. I know in a spoken word, they formalize that with snapping, but it's not real. You snap for everyone. It's not as authentic as laughter, I think. I love spoken poetry or whatever.
But the snap is implied. You know the snap is coming every time.
It's
In comedy, you're not guaranteed the laugh every time you say something.
Well, it's exactly. Whether you're funny or not, if you're like at an open mic or something, or God forbid you were paid to be there and you just weren't funny, there's always somebody to say, give it up for so-and-so, and then clapping follows.
Right. Even if they had a terrible set, you're still gonna clap for them out of respect. Yeah. They bared their soul down in front of a stage, in front of a crowd of people, you know? At least you could do is clap for them.
And some people will really bare their soul and then not get laughter. Yeah.
It's very cringeworthy when that happens. But I do like what you had to say, Angel, about it's reminding people that they're okay. I love that. I've actually never thought of it under that perspective before. Cause you're right, you know, you gotta be having the worst week of your life, shitty, terrible week. You go out to a comedy set and there's this one comedian that really just makes you get that bellow of laughter. And you're right, if you can laugh like that, well, okay, life still keeps on. We're still here. I can still laugh. That's nice.
Exactly. It's always interesting because you can go to like small towns where they've never seen comedy before, and they won't clap because they don't have that convention. They don't have the convention of clapping on stage.
So okay.
You have to physically tell them clap, motherfuckers. So, but everyone knows, hey, laugh. Everyone, yeah. That's universal, and I always really like that. Plus. I always compare comedy and poetry. With poetry, you kind of dig yourself into a corner,
okay,
where you don't know if you're crazy or not,
okay,
because you have to get someone to read your poetry and they're never actually gonna read it.
Uh-huh.
And even if they did, they're gonna be like, oh, it was good. But with stand-up, you can make sure you're not crazy by going to a group of people and basically just polling this idea, like, do we all feel this way, or do
yes.
we all, or do you at least empathize?
I like that idea too. It reminds me of when Greg does stand up here and again, and he'll always run ideas by me, and we'll kind of go back and forth. And it's always as fun talking about the joke as it is making the jokes. It's like, well, this is funny because of this. This isn't really hitting because of this, and so on.
If it makes me feel good to talk about it, which laughing is included with that, then. That's what it's really about. Like, getting up on stage and actually sharing that bit is secondary to how it made me feel coming up with it.
Yeah, exactly. It's, I don't, there's some jokes that you know will get laughs, but you just don't want to do them because you're like, I know this will work, so I'll just do the one that I'm working on.
It's yeah. the cheap laughs. You don't want the cheap laughs. You want it's not, something different from that.
It's not even that they're cheap, that they're very formulaic.
Okay.
Okay.
There's like some jokes that don't, like a sex joke won't necessarily be formulaic or rely on relating to the audience.
Okay.
But you won't know if it works because it doesn't follow the math of it.
Okay.
I don't know. Do you get that?
I do, and I want to touch on it a bit because there, in talking to Joe about this and some other people, it's, I was rambling a couple days ago about comedy and the science of comedy, but ended with, it's not science, comedy is philosophy. But there is formula to comedy, I would admit that. And in a way there is science to it, but I just feel at the end of it all, it becomes more philosophical in that we're dealing with emotions and feeling and almost irrational output at times. But on that point, there is formula.
Yeah, exactly. I remember I was reading like a interview from like Yeats or whatever, and he was talking about how there's a philosophical game in poetry. None of the stuff he talks about is necessarily true. Like, it wouldn't stand up in a logic class, but the game of it is funny, or not funny for him. The game of it's poetic, or whatever. So. It's not necessarily because the game's formulaic, but it has to work with some level. It has to be empathizable to the everyday person.
What is some of that formula specifically in regards to comedy?
You know, just simple things like what's misdirection, knowing the act out. There's some formulas are very specific, like a new formula I figured out was that you can use hyperbole for solutions. Like, my school is very diverse. Everyone was Mexican. You take it to the extreme where it's no longer true at that end. It's a scarecrow formula. That's what it is.
Okay.
It's not true philosophically, but it works on a lot of things.
You know, it's interesting because you see that formula used all the time in very different ways, but it seems what stands out to me about you is you've noticed the formula. You put words specifically like you can use hyperbole for solution, where someone might just do it just because inside or in their mind, they just essentially think it's funny or it just kind of comes out naturally like that. So it sounds like you really have broken it down to a science.
A little bit. What it is that I notice you start to notice that if you do these jokes in a row, they sound too similar.
Okay.
And once you do that, you're like, oh, they're similar because I have this formula I've been using and I don't even notice.
You're getting that pattern recognition.
Yeah, it is neural networking. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. It's a subconscious
conditioning
that you don't even know is working, but it is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, humans rely on patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And comedy is not exceptional to that at all. Not many things are. What I was gonna ask is, as somebody who is versed in literature, maybe it's a loaded question for myself, but do you believe in using Chekhov's gun?
Sometimes.
Let's go into what is that, because I don't even know what that is.
I'm going to, but I want him to answer first.
Okay.
Why don't we explain it first so I can come up with an answer?
Okay, no, that works. Chekhov's gun is a function, or let's just call it a function for everyone out there, within literature or other forms of exposition, in which it can be done in film now more than, like, that people would be more aware of it in film. And was literally the idea of, if there is a gun shown, that gun will be used. And in that way, it's illusion, it is foreshadowing, it is setting up an expectation, even if subconsciously, that something bad could happen. Something bad is going to happen. This weapon is going to be used. And then maybe you can add to that.
Sure. I think what it comes down to is it's a combination of brevity and just narrative formula.
Okay.
Where you want it so that the audience thinks that everything they see that's important or visually stunning is going to be important to the plot. So yes. When you see a gun, and that's very dramatic, you're going to want that to be used, because you don't want that to be extra clutter in the formula. You can have plenty of clutter in comedy, but if you're doing a narrative, that's pretty nice. Bits don't have the follow formula, because you can just kind of move on. You just have to end on the punchline. But if you're doing a story, it would probably be better to do it that way. I don't really do stories. I do the philosophical, not philosophical, observational comedy.
It is philosophical, though, at least in this. I guess for somebody like me, I see the philosophy in it, in the cerebralness to what might be going into your writing. But it's swift when you deliver. It just comes. And it could be almost a one-liner, but there's a lot that goes into it. It's very subtle. This is me speaking specifically about what I see in your comedy. There's more to it, but just in that. I was gonna ask if you like The Aristocrats.
I never seen it.
Are you talking about the Disney movie?
Are you talking about the joke?
The joke.
Oh, yeah. By Gilbert Gottfried? Is that what we're talking about? That one?
It's not him who came up with it, but he's one of the Phyllis Diller, Gilbert Gottfried. In fact, there's even a movie where you have about 20 comedians just talk and muse and deliver The Aristocrats. Even Drew Carey is one of them. I always found odd.
This is weird. Yeah. It's very weird.
Bob Saget delivers one of the dirtiest Aristocrats deliveries ever.
Oh, that's great. Bob's him of all people.
Oh, it's like bad. Golden showers and coming hair and all this crazy shit.
I would invite anyone who's not familiar with this joke that Greg is talking about to go ahead and look it up.
Yes.
I would advise otherwise. I do not remember the punchline. I don't remember if it was a good joke or not. I just remember, wow, this is intense.
Because it's not about the punchline.
It's not? Well, it's about it not being there.
And there's talk or thought of it really being a joke for comedians.
It is a little, because we're desensitized, because we've heard all the worst shit.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about philosophically. I think it's more or less of a taste thing, or like, oh, I want to see, I want to see the darkest shit possible. I want to, they kind of out the blood a little bit in comics.
Right.
Yeah. I'm not quite sure if that's necessarily what makes a joke good, but comics are kind of like, oh, that's refreshing.
Exactly. and other people are just frightened and think you're a heinous creature.
They're probably right.
In my case. So one of the best, or one of my favorite ways to flip that and to tell that to normal, air quotes, people, is to go ahead and, right, it's the, for everyone out there, still go look it up. I'm not gonna tell a whole spiel of the Aristocrats, but it's wholesome family walks into an agent's office. They go ahead and perform their act for said agent to get booked on his show or what have you. And in this act, it just is filled with depravity and gruesomeness and terribleness and all kinds of sights and sounds that is this large buildup, no matter how brief or long, that ends with, as they walk out because they're kicked out of this place, and he is disgusted and utterly ashamed to be a part of anything like this. He goes, "But wait, what are y'all called? What are you called?" And somebody in the group turns around and says, "Well, we're the Aristocrats."
So you were mentioning earlier that there's a film, a movie, where a lot of people are doing the same joke.
Like a documentary, okay. If you will.
But they're changing it up based off of their own taste or whatever comes up to them with it. One thing I like that Greg likes to talk about a lot is all jokes that will exist, that have ever existed, have already been told. How do you feel about that, Angel?
iPhone jokes.
iPhone jokes?
Yeah, they're new. Uh-huh. No one's written an iPhone joke in 1960.
But they maybe had telephone jokes in 1960.
Yeah, but they don't have jokes about Google Maps.
And then maybe before 1960 and like the 1800s or before, when were phones invented? I don't know when phones were invented, but maybe there was mail carrier pigeon jokes that they started making. So I guess the idea
let's draw back a little bit, because you are right. Like, there was not an iPhone joke in the 1960s. But the idea comes from, there are infinitely new ways to execute a joke, but in essence, every joke that's already been told or will be told has already been told. And just this framework of, even Jesus was telling the same jokes, if you believe in that. I'm not going to get into that. That we hear today, it's just the context. So when you think of a phone joke or an iPhone joke, you could argue that, well, there's a baby crying in the background.
That's very distracting. Don't know if you guys can hear the baby, but I hope you don't.
it's my baby. Okay, and the idea is, look, Google Maps was not on a phone 50 years ago, but perhaps there was this joke about Alexander Graham Bell inventing the phone, or somebody having to... There's always a joke about communication, about delivering a message, about a message being misconstrued, about directions not being right. There's the old thought that, right, men don't stop and ask for directions. Uh-huh. And in that way, that could be translated over time into a Google Maps joke.
Yeah, it's true. You could use an old joke on a new format, or you could make a new joke with a new observation that people just now have. Like, there's a bunch of new jokes about people using their phone during the bathroom, right?
That's true.
Right? That's a new thing people do. Because I guess people used to read, but that wasn't like a
magazine or something.
They used to, yeah. But that was never funny, because they don't take the magazine with them.
Right.
They don't carry the book around them their whole lives. Uh-huh. So this dirty thing about how we can't... Uh-huh. We have this book while we're on the toilet with our unwiped hands. It's gross.
I want to say we've talked about this on one of our earlier episodes, where if you borrow someone's phone, you're pretty much touching their poop phone.
Exactly. Yeah.
that's a poop phone.
Yeah, there's always new jokes, I feel.
Okay, I like that.
I think it's applicable to more than technology, but that's probably the best example.
Gotcha. This is a great dropping point before we go into our sponsor's message. Before we go, I will just quickly share the flip of the Aristocrats that I quite prefer in delivering to, again, like my parents. My mom is terrified about whenever I do something like this.
You told your mom this joke?
Yeah. It's, I'll make it super quick. Family goes into an agent's office, asks to take stage, show him what he's got, show him what they've got for an audition. They get on stage, and it is the most beautiful act ever seen, with the daughter singing beautifully, the son being an acrobat, the father being the funniest comedian that ever lived, and the mother being able to play a harp like no other person has ever played. And there's even a little chihuahua that can do flips and jump through hoops and play with fire. And he loves them. And he says, oh my God, you have to come on my show. I will book you. And he goes, but wait, what are you called? And he, somebody replies, oh, we're the white supremacist grandma sodomizing cocksuckers.
And on that note, here's a message from this week's sponsors.
This fall comes a new show from the creators of How I Met Your Mother and Cupcake Wars. There was only one man who could change the chef and culinary scene, and his name was Renoir.
My name is Chef Mandel Renoir. I came to America a few years back, and I tasted the food and thought it was terrible, and thought, I think I could take advantage of all these Americans with my food. And so that's what I did.
I had first tasted Renoir's food in 1996. It was a restaurant in Los Angeles. I had been a food critic at that point for 10 years and won a James Beard in writing. That's pretty irrelevant to this, but I just can't help myself but talk about my experience. Renoir, on the other hand, taught me something I had never encountered before, and it was that perhaps food could make me understand why that priest touched me growing up.
I first got into cooking when I was a little baby. My mother, she would cook meals for me and my family every day, and every time I tasted it, I'd, this is terrible! So, of course, naturally, I took over the kitchen and became a chef.
Renoir and I became friends close after that first time I sat into his restaurant in Los Angeles. It was called Wine Bastard. It was quite a culinary experience. It was really only natural that he would get 7 Michelin stars by the year 2000. I've never seen a chef master control of his staff quite like him.
So, Arlene, I see that you made cupcakes for us today. Tell us a little bit about this cupcake.
Yeah, Chef, this is a recipe from my grandmother, and she's been gone for many, well, it's familiar, it's a family recipe. I'm just so nervous, Chef.
That's okay, Arlene, don't be nervous. This is a place where we can all be vulnerable and show off our talents. Let me taste your cupcake.
Yeah, Chef.
So, Arlene, you said that your grandmother, she passed away?
Quite some time ago.
Did you happen to use her ashes for the recipe? Because this is the driest, most disgusting piece of shit cupcake I've ever seen! Get out of my kitchen!
Renoir, some would call a complete another asshole, but I call him genius. There was one time Renoir and I... Well... I just won't give it away, but let's just say we enjoyed a French getaway at a sauna in a Greek restaurant in a Chinatown in Galveston, Texas, and it was magical.
Look, I don't know why this man thinks that he can be friendly or close with me. I mean, I could put a McRib on a fancy plate and serve it to him, and he would probably give me another Michelin star, you know what I mean?
This fall. One man on kitchen tables.
Put some more butter on that. It needs more butter. That's not enough butter.
Welcome back, everybody. That was a delightful ad. Have you ever tried Chef Renoir's food, Greg?
I actually went to a taco truck he opened up once in Austin.
And well, how was it?
It was, I mean, he's got 5 Michelin stars.
On a taco truck?
From the, he got 3 of them from the taco truck specifically.
Oh my god, that's impressive. That's
is it,
great.
Is it really?
Yeah, kinda, yeah.
You know, I think I might prefer Gordon Ramsay.
Oh my god, you can't, he's gonna stop being our sponsor if he hears you say that.
I used to get really baked and watch the original Kitchen Nightmares.
Uh-huh.
And I just have this nostalgia for
that it. That sounds disturbing. But anyways, welcome back, everybody. This is the Wild Bunch comedy-based podcast episode with our guest, Angel. What's your last name again, Angel?
Baeza.
Angel Baeza. Forgot that. I'm sorry, guys.
You're a prick.
Every time I go to Austin, they call me Angel Smith.
Angel Smith?
Yeah.
Why is that?
They're like, ah, it's Mexican, I can't say it.
Oh, wow, you'd think that Austin would be a little bit more acculturated.
I don't know, to me that's very indicative of Austin culture.
Tomato, tomato.
Vegan tacos, it's all...
Everything's jackfruit.
So, we talked a lot about stand-up, a lot about, you know, joke structure and what goes into a joke. Now we're kind of bringing it back more to our own point of views on comedy, our own preferences. I know we were talking about this earlier, Angel, but you mentioned your favorite comic was who?
Probably Norm Macdonald.
Go into that. Why is he your favorite? Why does he stand out to you?
Well, part of my favorite is his delivery.
Okay.
He has one of those sort of those voices where you can say anything and it's funny.
Uh-huh.
And I explained earlier, what he does is that... He'll act like he's really dumb. He'll you know, mumble the setup, and then he'll say the punchline clearly, which I can't really do with all my jokes, but I do with some of them, and it's great for just showing, kind of like the service of a thing.
Okay.
Just like, that's hard to explain. It's great for showing how things are by pretending to be a dumb person.
Ah, I like that.
And sharper than, in which, his punchline literally cuts through everything he set up before, and actually subverts, like, himself.
Okay.
And you can do that with a joke, but then he's actually doing it with his personality and
so
delivery.
There's layers behind it.
As Angel was saying, I don't know if he said it on the podcast, might have been earlier before we were recording, but Norm Macdonald has layers, despite not seeming as if. One of my favorite Norm Macdonald characters is Burt Reynolds.
I love
from
SNL.
That is hilarious,
but he does his Burt Reynolds.
And it's, right, does he look like Burt Reynolds? Does he actually sound so much like Burt Reynolds?
Not at all.
But it's one of the best impressions.
Oh, it's funny, it's hilarious, it makes you laugh.
The gum smacking, just... I can't do it, but it's actually... When I used to think about doing stand-up before I was doing it more regularly like I am now, I would always look to that impersonation specifically as a way to kind of hype myself up in delivering stand-up.
Uh-huh.
Who's your favorite comedian, Joe?
I have a few, to be honest with you.
Just name two.
I will name two. I was actually going to specifically name two. And those two are, the first one's going to be, and this is probably a generic answer, but I don't care because I hold to it. Jim Carrey.
Jim Carrey.
I love Jim Carrey. His stand-up, okay, but I love him more so for the things he's done with movies. He always plays this very underdog, lame, loser of a character, right? But for some reason, this loser of a character is at most in touch with himself than anybody else in the movie. You know, there's always that cool guy in the movie, but the cool guy is... either an asshole or just isn't in line with who he is. Whereas Jim Carrey, he knows he's this dumb loser, but he's okay with that. And in that, it makes him confident and not a loser at all. He ends up being the most lovable character of the movie. And his slapstick's just freaking hilarious. Like, he does things that people just, no one else could do it other than Jim Carrey.
Did you ever watch him on In Living Color?
No, I didn't. Actually, I was having a conversation about that the other day with one of my coworkers. He's like a fireman, right? Firefighter?
Mm-hmm.
But I never saw it. I never saw it, so that's all I got to say about that one.
I did not expect that to end that way.
Yeah, that's all it was.
Your second?
My second would be Chris Farley. Now, Chris Farley is more so because of his body movements in comedy. He made you laugh because your attention was on him the whole time. Because, I mean, this is a 300-pound dude doing flips on stage. Like, what the fuck? Like, that's crazy and impressive that any... I can't do a flip. I'm not 300 pounds. So it's impressive, and it keeps you captivated.
Yeah, he's great. I love him so much. He's more of an actor.
Yeah.
Because I thought we were doing stand-ups.
So, but oh, comedy's comedy.
Comedy's comedy. That's so... Because there's so fewer physical comedians. There's not really a formula for it. It just...
Uh-huh.
It's
your how can you speak with your body in a way that's patterned?
Right.
I think maybe each of these more physical comedians have their own patterns, but you really can't develop a pattern based on these different, like, right? Have you studied every slapstick comedian from Charlie Chaplin to, like, was Kevin Hart kind of a slapstick comedian now?
He's not a physical one, but he slaps.
He'll have his moments. He'll have his physical moments, but that's not like his thing.
But it only works if The Rock is throwing
him. I know, right? Seriously. Dane Cook did a lot of body movements. He's not my favorite comedian, but he really got famous because he would incorporate this outlandish like movements during his storytelling, which was always captivating toward the audience. Remember the one special he had, he was on a stage that was instead of facing everyone, it was a stage in the middle of a whole crowd, and it was a circle. And he uses every inch of that circle going back and forth and around, and it's very exciting and entertaining to watch.
That's arena comedy.
Yeah.
Which, I don't know. Not to discount arena comedy at all.
Uh-huh.
But I think we're very spoiled in having a comedy scene locally where we're very intimate with who we're watching.
Mm-hmm.
And you can be right there in front of them. And right makes jokes land harder.
Right.
It makes jokes land more softly at times where...
Oh, I've seen bits where it's funnier when the comic interacts with the crowd than their actual bit that they set up
right.
to begin with.
Yeah, that's what I love about the Blind Tiger Comedy Club. That's what I love about it.
The There's that machine. Second plug, guys.
Yeah, second plug. One every 5 minutes. Has it been 5 minutes yet?
I'll let you know.
It's very intimate because you can look at their faces. I will say I've seen an intimate thing done with the circle format. Drog Carmichael's a new guy. He did that.
Okay.
And he filmed his most recent HBO special in a literal Mason Lodge.
Okay. That's cool.
So it's like this pulpit and it's a circle, but it's like just this time. It's made for one person.
Okay.
And it's intimate, and he actually talks to people in this big giant room.
Uh huh.
But it's also like an arena size. So there's ways to get past that, I think.
Okay. That is this fusion of environment and setting that, I mean, right? Okay, yeah. If perhaps there's not... Okay, let's... Going back to how many times can you tell a joke and if there's new jokes, there's layers to even that and how you're delivering, which the place, the setting starts to evolve too. It's not just about the jokes anymore or the writing. It's about where it's at. And literally where people are sitting around you and how many there are and what it sounds like when you speak. Do you need a mic? Or is there acoustics where you don't have to have a mic?
Right.
And that even changes what's delivered and how it's delivered and how then it is received and thought of as funny. Have you ever been heckled?
I have been heckled. A couple times.
Oh?
Sometimes it's good. Sometimes they tell you something you need to know. Like, I remember I was bombing one time at a mic. And this guy kept like trying to point at me, right? I was like, why are you waving your hand so much? And he was just speaking the sign language. Because like, there are 5 people who are deaf. I didn't even know. And he was just trying to explain it to me. I was like, oh, I'll get it.
That's hilarious.
Well, I like that story because it's like, what do you do anyway? Like, why are you here? You're deaf. What was the other time?
I don't know. Sometimes people just want to have a conversation, though, because they want to be on stage, but they're too afraid to do it, so they'll just heckle you. So like, I'll be talking about Tinder, and then some lady talks about how all guys are whores.
That's okay. Random.
Am I allowed to say that?
Oh, of course.
Oh yeah.
Okay. She'll say all guys are whores. I'm like, do you really want to have this conversation right now? I was gonna end this joke differently.
On your Tinder profile, do you have that you do stand-up comedy?
I don't use Tinder. I just pretend for jokes.
But that'd be good. Do stand up. That you'd probably get a lot of matches if you did do that.
Maybe.
You do. I'm always wondering about the sexual appeal of comedians. And it's like, is there actually a sexual appeal, or does it take somebody who's somewhat attractive already, and then if they say they're a stand-up comedian, whether they are that funny or not, it's just like, oh, he's a comedian. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I will give my perspective. Women that can make me laugh automatically become more attractive in my mind. Oh, yeah. Like, if they can really make me laugh, like, genuine laughter, oh, yeah, they're super attractive. I like that.
I feel as if my sense of humor can scare women off. Really, like, I mean, if I'm going to talk about growing up as an altar server and wanting to get fucked by a priest. And in San Antonio, a woman grew up Catholic, and she's very connected to her family, and she still goes to Sunday Mass. It's red flags.
Yeah, but how well was that relationship gonna work out? If that's who you are, it's probably for the best.
Me and Father Fitzgerald had a really, really loving relationship. No, thank you. In the greater scheme of things that we talk about, that's an excellent point. Like, okay, if somebody's sense of humor isn't aligned with me anyways, then it's a greater tell of how that overall relationship can go.
Yeah, no, that's a great point that Angel brings up, because as much as I like women that can make me laugh, I like women that I make laugh. I don't know, maybe it's an ego thing or a validation thing.
It's also...
But it's part of that banter that you can have. If you're laughing, you're having a good time. It's comedy's part of flirting.
Well... Yeah.
Well, they're probably pretending to laugh too.
That's fine. Yeah. That's okay with me also.
I am also totally cool with it. Right.
Yeah. Humor is a tale of aligned perspective, right? Uh-huh. So humor's based on shared experiences and that mob mentality of having an audience all laugh with you. So it's also a tale of, okay, if this person does think what I think is funny, then there is this alignment and overlap of perspective and possibly experience that could be a greater foreshadowing of a good relationship.
It's a thing of like, oh, yeah, they get me. Yeah. And that feels nice. You feel understood.
Oh, you feel nice.
I feel nice.
Speaking of females in comedy, one of my favorite comics is Maria Bamford.
Oh, she's great.
Who is she?
She was the Target lady in a series of ads. You actually mentioned her the other day.
So, I did?
Yes, you asked if you thought that somebody was Maria Bamford.
Is she the one from Bridesmaids?
No.
No, that's Kristen Wiig.
She's hilarious. Yeah. Who's Maria Bamford?
She has two Netflix specials, and she's like this bipolar blonde lady. She's very funny, though. She's probably the funniest comic.
She is.
Hold on, audience, because this is going to bug me. Hey, Siri. Show me images of Maria Bamford.
You'll need to unlock your iPhone.
God.
Wow.
I wish I could do a decent impression of her, because I feel like once you hear her, you know.
Matches in your photos library. Oh! She's hilarious. Yes. Okay, yes. She is extremely funny.
I remember the first time I saw her was on Patton Oswalt's indie comedy special from 5 years back, even more. It's got Brian Posehn, Patton Oswalt, the one guy, I forget his name, who does the bit about sucking dicks in an alley, where it's he's just haphazardly going from one dick to another while crying. Well, you guys can't see what I was doing, but
yeah, you're just sucking a dick right there. Like, I thought he was going to act it out, but he brought one out, so oh, wow, it's got a podcast.
It was just a dick, too, not even a person attached to it.
I don't know who's going to wipe the blood off, but it's not me.
Oh, it's me. Maria Bamford is one of my favorites because of how she wears that affliction on her sleeve. So, her bipolarness, her mental disorder, whatever she calls it, is something that is interwoven into her act constantly. And she always goes back to that in some way. A local comic who does this that I really enjoy is Abby Bennis. I don't know if that's, she's, that's odd.
We saw her at Blind Tiger?
Yep.
Okay, I know you're, okay. It's, she's very good. She's a funny girl.
It's odd to bring up somebody who's local on this podcast. I don't know, like, she would ever listen, but.
Just text her.
Just text her, hey, you're on this podcast.
I will. Next time I see her, I'll say I mentioned her.
We saw her at Blind Tiger Comedy Club. There's your plug. It was about 5 minutes, Angel. Just for you.
Thank you.
But Blind Tiger is one of my favorite venues in town because of, it's like, those are funny people who do it because they enjoy comedy.
Right.
Yeah, none of us screen painted that show.
I do love the vibe of walking downstairs into this weird, mystical, almost looking room that people are doing comedy in. It feels cool. It feels like you're part of a private club or something.
That's the point of it. It's sort of like, we're not going to tell people you don't like. It's a speakeasy.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
There's no password there, but it's sort of like, oh, these are people who think we would get it.
Yeah.
Because it's like, who else is going to go see a comedy show at midnight?
Right.
You want to be there.
Yeah, exactly. We make it as hard as possible.
I mean, it's under the time, the
magic time machine. I used to work there, actually. Yeah.
What would you dress as?
Spock. How's Spock?
Cool. Oh, make a good Spock.
Yeah, that's very fitting. That's cool. Okay. What's this one of your favorite funny movies?
I've never really been into funny comedies. I don't like movies that are funny.
What kind of movies do you like? Schindler's List.
You know what's a funny movie, but like not so, that new Coen Brothers movie on Netflix, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
We were talking about it.
I want to see.
Haven't
that.
Seen it yet.
It's
though.
It's so good. It gets the violence. It has really a lot of really funny violent gags.
Okay.
Like there's this point where, because in the Wild West, there's a point where an Indian gets an arrow through another guy's neck. Right?
Uh-huh.
And that's insane. And you see him take it out, and you're like, wow, he's surviving. And then he gets another one.
I do like that. Like, Charlie Chaplin today watching comedy would be like, what the fuck? I mean, maybe. Or maybe he'd enjoy all the different.
Or maybe he'd
of...
be like, man, I wish I could have done that kind of thing, you know?
Well, I never saw Charlie Chaplin miming dick sucking.
I'm sure it happened.
Robert Downey Jr. played him in the one.
See? I just met him with a little mustache, the little Hitler mustache.
Yeah. I mean, Robert Downey Jr. did do that for drugs. What's one of your favorite comedy movies?
Step Brothers is hilarious. I love Step Brothers because it's ridiculous. Like, who the heck came up with this idea and made just this classic movie out of nowhere? I love Step Brothers.
Mm. Speaking of Coen Brothers, one of my favorite movies of all time is The Big Lebowski.
Big Lebowski is good.
And I love it not just because of like the way it's funny, but it's a noir. It's a noir based on, you have Dashiell Hammett, and he wrote Maltese Falcon and Red Harvest. Both are about this hard-boiled detective coming into the seedy town and uncovering this mystery and web of lies. And right, the detective knows what he's doing, even if at times the unexpected happens. Whereas, all right, that's a noir.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
The Big Lebowski is about the dude not being that hard-boiled detective, but stumbling through this web of lies and like all the same sort of aspects, but he doesn't know what's going on and he doesn't want to be there. He just wants his rug.
If you guys haven't seen The Big Lebowski, you should probably do it tonight or as soon as you listen to this podcast.
Yeah. Go out and buy it or hire it. Maybe I don't make money.
We can tell people to go ahead and pirate something. I don't think anybody's.
That's gonna... fine. Yeah, you can do it.
Do drugs too. That's what.
I mean, but if you're into that.
Yeah, you can tell I've been drinking this half.
Well, I don't know. So.
I thought that was coconut water. So this guy comes in, it looks like the little coconut waters that you see at gas stations and like the cardboard boxes. And we're looking at him drinking, so it looks like coconut water. No, what is that, Greg? Greg's holding the cardboard bottle.
It's a Pinot Grigio wine cube with aromas of green apple and citrus. But guess what? It's won 300 plus awards.
Wow. Yeah. What kind of awards?
I don't know, like, can you imagine me standing outside of a gas station saying, hey, I give this best coconut water shaped wine award. There's one. It's got 299 more.
I have a question for you, Angel. So I saw a Greg do stand-up last night. It went really great, and it was funny, and it was fun, and it was exciting. And I had this urge where I was like, man, I want to try that. I want to get up on stage. I want to tell a story. I want to make people laugh. Mm-hmm. For someone who's never done it before and may be curious about it, what advice would you give them?
Start out with, like, one joke.
Okay.
That's what you want to start out with, so they don't think you're a crazy person.
What do you mean by that, like, one joke?
So, you know, there's a point of comedy where, like, it's relatable and you're like, I'm just going to tell a story and they're going to get me. And
sure.
You can try that, but I would recommend you start off with a joke.
Okay.
Just so they know you're not crazy.
Okay.
And that's my best.
I almost want them to think I'm crazy.
No. That is really, really, really good advice because there was a gentleman who had, like, this suede velvet jacket on and, like, this top hat and he had a cane.
Night, yeah. Long beard. He looked cool.
He did, but he sounded crazy.
That's true. That's a good point.
He just got up and started ranting, I woke up yesterday from a nightmare.
it was a very cringeworthy dude.
So that's awesome.
Okay.
That's a great character, but I just want to know, am I allowed to laugh at this first? Just want to know, is there someone in there?
Okay, I like that. So tell a joke first and then get into whatever stuff that you're wanting to talk about.
Unfortunately, I think that was just George.
That was his character.
Is that his real name?
Yes.
It was George.
I enjoyed meeting him as a person when I did before he went up. I asked him if he was going to go up and he said, well, I'm going to go up and do a rant. And that's what he did, so...
So he was planned.
I applaud him for getting up and doing what he said he was going to do, because to your point, like, what is the advice?
Yeah.
Like, no matter what you do, if you don't get up and do what you want to do...
Right.
Then there's no point.
Yeah.
How do you... I've told you after your set before that you're fucking hilarious.
Thank you. I appreciate it every time.
It's still true. Yeah. Except for that one time.
There's many times it wasn't true.
How does that make you feel? Not just like for me, but like for anyone who comes up and tells you something.
I've never been very good at taking compliments well. Just this year, someone told me, hey, just say thank you. And then they usually cut the conversation. I love getting laughs, though. That's the real compliment. Just how you do on stage. That's the validation.
It's the high.
It's the high. Yeah. It's my drug.
Well, I mean, laughter is sort of like a drug.
A little bit, yeah. Like, I remember I used to have an app for jokes when I was, like, 12 or whatever, and I used to go through all of them.
There you go.
It's that dopamine release you get when you're laughing.
Dopamine, in fact. So, as I walk away from the mic and I come back with a book that I grew up with. I had not planned to pull this out, but this is the Friars Club Encyclopedia of Jokes.
Oh, wow. That sounds very official.
Yeah. It's like, I grew up loving comedy. And it's by category of different jokes from, it's even...
Oh, that's actually pretty cool. I've never seen one.
Alphabetized. Yeah.
Wait, is this like 1960 jokes?
It is up into the 90s, early 1000s, I believe.
From puns to dirty jokes to all kinds of jokes in there.
It's categorized by topic, like sex or sports or...
I see atheism marriage, right there.
Atheism, too. And then there's also a glossary of comedians. You can go through and see, like, jokes from specific comedians.
What I like about this book, man, I haven't looked at it in years, you've had it forever, but what I like about it is the jokes, if you read them, like if you're just scrolling through the book and you read them, they almost don't sound funny. But they're more like guidelines to the joke, and what makes them funny is however the person reads it, how they take it and deliver it and give their voice or their movements to it.
And there's different kinds of jokes. There's stories, there's anecdotes, there it goes on and on. There's one-liners. There's your like 1-2 punches.
Right.
Phyllis Diller, I want to say it's in this book where it's her simple Monica Lewinsky walks into a dry cleaner's. The guy behind the counter says, I already fucked it up. Because it's so simple, but it's like hard to like remember perfectly. Monica Lewinsky walks into a dry cleaner's, says to the guy behind the counter, can you go ahead and take care of these two dresses? Guy, hard of hearing, says, come again? And she goes, no, it's orange juice. Okay. Oh, this is a good callback to us talking about jokes and if there are new jokes, because that's only understandable if you've lived in the 90s or right that there's no way that would be understandable contextually 50 years ago before Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky.
Right.
So it's like it hinges on Monica Lewinsky.
A little bit, yeah. There's always new context, always new experiences. Yeah, I believe there's new jokes all the time.
I like that you're preaching this because I was this week vehemently saying every joke's already been told.
That would be super convenient if I just didn't have to write any new jokes. Just read what the practice says. There's no new jokes, guys. I'm just picking the best ones.
it's a good. I haven't read in years either. I actually, when I was like 12, read that front to back.
Yeah.
Wow. My parents were appalled because I was reading all
it
these.
It probably like, ruined you slightly.
Definitely. I would try to tell jokes out of that book to friends the same age, and they wouldn't get it. That was.
But you would get them, huh?
I did.
You were like, oh, that's how that works. I don't even get the joke.
Yeah.
because that's supposed to be funny. That's okay.
In that way, yeah. Like, it's just even be okay. This would be interesting. My mom taught me, my mom taught me the word faggot. Joe's face
now.
It sounds like, where could he be going?
What podcast is this?
The Wild Bunch.
And, to anyone who knows Martha out there, and if you're listening, Mom, I'm sorry.
Sorry, Miss Valdez.
But it happened.
You're Martha's son? That explains so much.
Holy shit. And I don't know why she yelled it at this guy crossing the street in front of us.
Jesus, Martha.
But she yelled it. And I asked, what does that mean? And she, from there, explained it to me. I would read jokes with that sort of language and not really understand what was being said, but still understood it was funny.
Uh-huh.
And I can't really go back and I can't explain why. I guess a part of it was that, it's a book of jokes. That's funny somehow. But that's what makes comedy timeless, where you can hear something and laugh because of a delivery, laugh because of the physical element, or laugh because other people are laughing, but then it can be cerebral enough to return to it. And like a good movie, a good story, what's going on here that you can return to it and say, oh shit, I never thought of that. Yeah. That's what I like about comedy.
Yeah, it's universal too. Like, even in British comedy, I don't always know what they're talking about. Because they use different words. Like, with cigars, they call those faggots, right?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And you'll listen to the joke and you'll find the joke funny, but also you learn a new thing. You're like, oh, they call those, they have different words.
They have different How do you feel about Monty Python?
Oh, I love them, but I'm not quite well versed in them, as they should be, because I'm not a big sketch comedian. But they're great. They've done a lot of good things.
As we wrap up, I think, okay, so there's talking about that in the different forms of comedy. So there's sketch comedy, there's stand-up comedy, there is written comedy, there's comedy in stories, and just, right, reading a funny story. Maybe that's more anecdotal. there are movies, there's even songs now. Weird Al. Mm-hmm. Where comedy is expressed in different forms. Like, did Socrates have comedy?
He was probably pretty funny.
I've heard some philosophical jokes, like, what's it called? There was this philosopher who went to Plato said that a human was an animal with no feathers, no fur, and stood on two legs, and a philosopher put a chicken on his door and then plucked it.
Okay.
Well, it's like that comedy that comes from wit.
Yeah.
You know, like a Frasier or Kelsey Grammer type comedy where it's all about the timing and what's being said. Yeah, exactly. I love witty based comedy. Sitcoms have this a lot.
Yeah, except for Friends.
I hate Friends. We're probably gonna lose a couple of listeners
about fuck this. Them.
But I don't care. I don't like Friends.
I don't either. You?
I don't have friends.
Do you ever reflect on making people feel a certain way through your comedy? So there's a compliment. So obviously they thought you were funny and they came up and they complimented you. But beyond that, do you ever do it just for them?
I'm gonna be honest, I'm very selfish.
That's great.
Yeah, I do it mostly for me. I'm not really focused on the audience. I want it to be good because I want them to have a good night. I know they paid for it often. But at a mic, I'm focusing on what's most true to me. I don't think of the audience very much.
I think that's wonderful because...
You just like everything I do.
No, not everything. I have nothing specific to point out that I don't like everyone, but...
There's plenty.
There's maybe you're tasting wine.
Yeah, that's 300 awards, and it was $3. That's 100 awards for a dollar.
Hey, okay, I'm not gonna lie. If I was still drinking, I'd probably drink that. I like the idea of if one person can come up to me and say that they liked it, then I did a good job. I went out last night telling Joe, I'm just gonna try to make you laugh.
It worked.
But to me, that's just, like, I don't know. Yes, I want to be laughed at. Yes, I want people to enjoy it. It is somewhat selfish in that way too. Like, I want to be able to bring something to people to make them think a different way, whether it's like satirical or revealing something about myself and then turning that into a joke that says something larger. But if I go to an open mic or I go to anything like that, I'm just trying to make me laugh.
Right.
Like if I get up and have a good time and I bomb, then it was still a good time. Mm-hmm. And if I laughed along the way, then that was therapy and healing or whatever you want to like go into that room of cliches, make it about. It was that. And that's what I like about comedy. Selfishly. Like, yes, there's the other side where we're giving something to the people or people pay or... Right, you know, they're just very, 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 very sad alcoholics who go yell at us at jokesters. Yeah, I said that. Oh, by the way, we're going to jokesters after this.
Yeah, we are.
Do it. But, Joe, you're really good at recapping.
Well, we talked about a lot, guys, and I hope it made at least one of y'all out there laugh, even just a little bit. Angel, really, really, really happy that you got to be on this podcast. I commend you, man, for everything that you're doing when it comes to stand-up, when it comes to this podcast. You're a very, very intellectual individual. I know you don't take compliments very well. I mean, he's cringing right now, guys, as I'm saying these things.
Do you take insults well?
I love it.
But no, man, it was an honor and a privilege to have you on the show. Really, really, you gave us a lot of perspective. I hope that you gave the listeners a lot of perspective as well. Keep those people laughing and stay selfish, because it seems like that selfishness is working and inadvertently giving something to a lot of people.
So go ahead and plug your next set.
My next set, probably this Friday, the Blind Tiger Comedy Machine.
On the 30th, we'll have Abby Rosenquist, who's been at the Montreal Comedy Festival, Just for Laughs.
Yeah.
Pretty good. You guys should go. And then I'll be sometime later.
Sounds good. Well, you heard it, folks, this Friday at Blind Tiger Comedy Club.
It is... What is today? There's a, it's Thanksgiving week.
It is the 18th. And yeah, it's also Thanksgiving week.
So Friday... November 23rd at Blind Tiger Comedy. There's a 10 p.m. show and then a midnight show. Usually, right?
Yeah.
So check that out, everyone. Look out for Angel. And
make sure to give him a bunch of compliments.
Yeah, yeah.
If you ever see him in public, just surround him.
I regret everything.
And on that note, thank you, listeners. We are the Wild Bunch.
Have a good one.
From the makers of How I Met Your Mother and Little House on the Chopping Block comes a new series from Hootflix. He was a chef from France. What I liked about Renoir more than anything was his ability to take a meal and turn it into the sublime. I knew after I first sat in his restaurant in 1992 that I had to tell the world I was a pansexual.
The fact is, the man is just quite excellent at what he does, and I might say he's very sexy. My name is Chef Renoir. I came to America thinking to myself, the food is so terrible here. I would make a lot of money taking advantage of all these fat Americans. So that's what I did.
Chef Renoir taught me about how to taste the flavor of life, really. I mean, you've never really had a Twinkie until you've had it made by Chef Merder Renoir.
What inspired me to cook was always my mother's cooking. I would see her in the kitchen making meals for me and my papa, and every time I would taste a puh! Mom, this meal is shit! So, of course, I took over and became a chef.
I've never seen a chef like Renoir. No other chef can command a kitchen like he has. He takes his students and he tends them as if a drill sergeant into something else.
So, Eileen, I see you have made cupcakes for us today. Tell me about this cupcake.
Well, these cupcakes are actually from my mother's grandma's recipe that she passed down from generation to generation. And I've made a few tweaks, Chef, but I think that it really holds true that my mother's grandmother's family recipe.
Okay, let me go ahead and taste this, Eileen. Your grandmother, she passed away?
She's been dead for quite some while.
Is this cupcake, does it happen to be made with her dead remains? Because it's disgusting!
Chef.